Welcome to the Deep Dive. We dig into the source materials you care about, pull out the key knowledge, the surprising bits, and tailor it just for you.
And today, we're really zeroing in on a specific source, episode 37 from the Military Tales YouTube channel. It's a full interview with Stan Nelson.
That's right. Stan Nelson, a retired Air Force Senior Master Sergeant in E-8, which is pretty high up, and he was a flight engineer, specifically with the 40th Aerospace Rescue and Recovery Squadron.
Yeah, during the Vietnam War. So our goal here, our mission, if you like, for this deep dive is to unpack his experiences from that interview, episode 37, and really get some insights into helicopter rescue back then from someone who was actually there doing the job.
Exactly. And for you listening, maybe you want the full picture but don't have hours to listen to the original, or you just want the highlights distilled, or we're aiming for that. Engaging, memorable details, those aha moments without getting, you know, too bogged down.
Right. So let's start with Stan Nelson himself as he presents in episode 37. His background is quite something.
It really is. He retired from the Air Force in 1980, 21 years of service. But that wasn't the end of his flying career, was it?
Not at all. As he talks about in the interview, he went on to teach at Parks College. Then he was training folks on helicopter systems for American Airlines down in Florida.
Okay.
And what's really interesting, and you hear this in episode 37, is how that experience then led him to the Gulf Coast, working offshore oil transportation, a really demanding field.
Offshore oil? Wow.
Yeah, he talks about dealing with platform hazards, blowouts, even coordinating hurricane evacuations for big names like Chevron and Exxon. You can imagine the pressure there.
Definitely. It shows how those military skills that focus on safety and procedure translates, right?
Absolutely. And as he details in the episode, that wasn't even the end of it.
No,
the oil industry had a downturn, mid-80s, he says.
Yeah.
So he shifted again, this time to commercial airlines. PSA first, out in San Diego, then U.S. Airways in Charlotte. Retired from there.
Quite the journey. And now he's in Maryville, Tennessee, he mentioned in the interview.
Yep. Really shows his adaptability and just this lifelong thing with aviation.
So let's rewind a bit back to the beginning, what actually got him into the Air Force in the first place, and then into helicopters. Episode 37 touches on this.
Well, the reason he gives in episode 37 is pretty straightforward, actually. He wanted warmer weather.
Chuckles slightly.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. He was doing construction work in 1959, freezing, and he and his buddy just decided, kind of jokingly, let's go to Texas, join the Air Force. And they pretty much did. Turned down recruiters from other branches. They wanted Air Force and sunshine.
Texas was the goal then, but that's not quite how the assignments worked out based on his story in the episode.
No, not exactly. After basic at Lackland, he says in episode 37, he was, kind of surprisingly, put into helicopters with just a few other guys.
Hmm.
Went to Shepherd AFB for helicopter school.
Okay, so far so good. Helicopter school.
Right. But his first assignment, even more unexpected, Goodfellow AFB. With the 10th Balloon Activity Squadron.
Balloons? Wait, what? As in actual balloons? How does that connect to rescue?
Ah, it chuckles. Yeah, sounds odd, doesn't it? But as Stan explains in the interview, their job was pretty specialized. They were recovering high-altitude air samples for the Atomic Energy Commission.
Huh. Air samples?
Yep. 8 missions a month, he says. Sometimes dry sampling where equipment parachuted down. Sometimes wet sampling where they collected air in bags and pumped it into containers. He did that for 5 years. Mm-hmm. West Texas, New Mexico in summer. East Texas, Louisiana in winter.
5 years collecting air samples for the AEC. That's definitely not what I pictured when thinking about his later rescue career. It's a fascinating detail from episode 37. So when did the shift towards rescue actually happen?
The change started, he recalls, summer of 63. The helicopter guys in their unit got folded into rescue operations. His first proper rescue assignment, he mentions, was Moran Air Base in Spain, flying H-43s there.
H-43s, smaller helicopters, right?
Yeah, LBR H-43s, LBR Mini Local Base Rescue. Moran was mainly a transit base for fighters crossing the Atlantic, so their job was mostly base support.
Spain. So not quite Southeast Asia yet. Did he have any major incidents or rescues there, according to episode 37?
Well, a really big one he recounts was the Palomares B-52 incident in January 66.
Oh, I've heard about that. The collision, the lost bombs.
Exactly. A B-52 and a KC-135 tanker collided, and 4 hydrogen bombs were dropped. Stan says in the interview they were sent out in their H-43 to help look for the wreckage, the bomb parts. 3 landed on shore, caused radiation contamination, alpha and beta, he said. 1 went into the med.
Finding pieces in H-bombs, that's a heavy first brush with major incidents.
Definitely. He mentions how big they were, too, like 2,300 pounds, 11 or 12 feet long. really puts it in perspective.
So after Spain, what was next? Did he head to Vietnam then? Episode 37 lays out his path.
Not straight away, no. Back to the U.S. first, he explains. Pair an AFB, another LBR unit with H-43s. Then Thompson AFB, still H-43s. Yeah. But then a colonel from Richard Bauer AFB in Missouri specifically picked him out, wanted him as a helicopter flight engineer.
Okay. A promotion or a specific role selection.
Sounds like it. That led to him getting sent TDY temporary duty to Eglin AFB. And that's where he trained on the H-53, the big one.
The H-53, the super jolly. That's a major step up from the H-43, isn't it? What kind of training did episode 37 say he got?
Oh, yeah. Big difference. He describes the training as pretty thorough. Weight and balance, obviously crucial. Understanding toll data, that's your takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
And landing data, performance figures based on weight, weather, all that.
Right. Essential stuff.
Absolutely. Fuel management, gunnery, water hoist practice, cargo sling work. And as the flight engineer, he says he was the one doing the power computations for hoist and sling loads, figuring out what the aircraft could handle in different conditions.
A lot of responsibility.
For sure. He also learned the differences between the H-53B and C models. The C model, he notes in the interview, had way more power. Nearly 4,000 horsepower versus maybe 3,000 for the B. Made a huge difference, especially somewhere hot and high like Thailand.
Okay, so he's craned up on the Super Jolly. How does he finally end up in Thailand with the 40th, according to the episode?
He says he was assigned directly to the 40th Aerospace Rescue and Recovery Squadron. They were part of the third group, which fell under the 41st Wing based out of Hickam in Hawaii.
And these were the Super Jollies.
Yep, that's what they call the H-53s, to distinguish them from the older HH-3 Jolly Greens. Though, interestingly, he mentions the pilots had their own nickname for them.
Oh, yeah.
Buffs. Stands for Big, Ugly, Friendly Fellas.
Chuckles. Buffs. I like that. Gives you a sense of the machine. So episode 37 touches on the early rescue efforts. What were the challenges before things like air-to-air refueling came in?
Big challenges. He explains that even with the earlier H-3s, range was a huge limitation. They often had to land at these secret airfields in Laos, called Lima sites.
Lima sites, I've heard of those.
Yeah, and refueling there often meant literally hand pumping fuel from 55-gallon drums into the helicopters. Imagine doing that, maybe under threat.
Wow, labor intensive and risky.
Totally. So air-to-air refueling, when it came in, was just a massive game changer, huge increase in range and how long they could stay on station.
Yeah.
He mentions General Adderholt's book talks a lot about setting up those Lima sites. He also notes that the very first rescue helos sent over TDY were actually H-43s with experienced crews before the H-3s and H-53s really established themselves.
So those early H-43 missions must have been incredibly tough.
Sounds like it. Limited range, like we said. He describes having a 55-gallon drum of fuel in the cabin sometimes, and the back was open, just a net. Made picking guys up on a Stokes litter that's the basket stretcher really difficult.
Doesn't sound ideal for combat rescue.
Oh, not at all. He even speculates an H-43 might have been the type involved in Pitsenbarger's Medal of Honor mission. The later F models had more armor, self-sealing tanks, he says, but still that range issue. Even the H-3s, which could go deeper into North Vietnam, needed those Lima site refueling stops before aerial refueling became common.
Okay, so Stan Nelson arrives in Thailand flying these buffs, the H-53 Super Jollies with the 40th. What exactly was his job on the aircraft during missions? Episode 37 goes into this.
He had several key roles. Pre-flight checks, obviously. Calculating the weight and balance, and that told data for takeoff and landing. Then, in the air, he was the number two gunner, operating one of the miniguns.
Okay, gunner. What else?
He was also the main hoist operator during rescues, and if they were doing cargo sling operations, he'd be giving directions to the pilot.
Running the hoist in combat? Oh, that sounds incredibly stressful. You've got the survivor down there, maybe enemy fire.
Yeah. He really emphasizes in episode 37 how vital the communication with the pilot was, guiding that hoist precisely. Typical hover height, he says, was 75 to 100 feet. But in really dense jungle, triple canopy, they might have to go way higher, maybe 245 feet, using almost the whole cable.
And lowering it through trees must have been tricky.
Hugely hazardous. He tells a story in the interview about an incident in Da Nang where they had to basically push into the trees to get someone out. Damaged the rotor blade so badly they had to replace them all, check the whole drivetrain. He notes those big H-53 blades could cut through a fair bit, but any damage caused serious vibration issues.
Makes sense. So he gets there, gets settled in. Then comes his first actual combat mission. Episode 37 details this, and it sounds like a rough introduction.
Oh, yeah. About a month in country, he says. He was on hybrid duty that day, the second helicopter in the rescue pair. They got scrambled, a North alert. His NCO was actually on the first helicopter, the Lowbird.
Okay, so he was initially the backup.
Right. But the Lowbird had a problem. Lost hydraulics coming off the refueling tanker, he says. Something about a second stage tailor roller failing. So suddenly, Stan's aircraft became the Lowbird, the primary rescue aircraft. They had to wait for another helicopter to come be their Highbird escort.
Right into the thick of it then. Where was the mission?
Up near the North Vietnamese border. An area called Bartholomew Pass, or the Fish's Mouth. They were trying to rescue the backseater from an F-4 Phantom, call sign Banyan 03, who'd ejected.
A dangerous neighborhood. What happened when they got there, according to his account in the episode?
They approach this karst outcrop where they think the survivor is. But Stan recalls no smoke initially. They do a quick hover, the pilot does a pedal turn, and bam, ground fire erupts.
Yeah.
From their 4 or 5 o'clock position, kind of tail level.
Whoa.
Yeah. The tail gunner got hit, 2 rounds through his parachute, but he just opened up with his minigun. Stan says the cabin just filled with smoke from the gunfire, and they still couldn't see the survivor's smoke. Turned out later the guy had thrown it downhill from his actual spot.
Chaos, getting shot at, smoke in the cabin, can't find the guy. How did they even try the rescue?
Well, Stan says in episode 37, he was leaning out the door, trying to lower the hoist carefully, didn't want to just drop it blind into the jungle, scanning for that red smoke marker. They made multiple passes, him guiding the pilot, but still couldn't spot it.
Under fire the whole time.
Sounds like it. Eventually, the aircraft commander told the number one PJ, the pararescueman, to get on the intercom and help spot the smoke. They searched again. PJ couldn't see it either. So after several tries, taking fire, they had to abort. Make that tough call.
Leaving someone behind, even temporarily. Gut-wrenching, you imagine. And was the flight back any easier after that? Episode 37 paints a pretty grim picture.
No, the return was hairy, too. They found bullet holes in their drop tanks, the external fuel tanks. Couldn't pressurize them, so couldn't use that fuel. Just had main tank fuel.
Not good. Low on fuel and damage.
Exactly. AC called for a tanker. They managed to refuel, incredibly, even with the damaged tanks leaking fuel everywhere. But during refueling, things got worse inside. A hydraulic line to the rear ramp got hit. Started spraying atomized hydraulic fluid, which is flammable, into the cabin. Stan describes it chillingly. One of the crew guys in the back just started screaming, thinking they were going to blow up. The Highbird pilot saw the leaks, got worried about an explosion, and moved his aircraft away. Stan's crew stayed hooked up to the tanker for like 40, 45 minutes, just trying to get enough fuel to make it to Lima Site 20 alternate. Landed there basically on fumes.
And the damage.
57 bullet holes in the aircraft when they counted. 57.
Unbelievable they flew it back. What was the feeling after landing, assessing that? Episode 37 gives a sense of it.
Yeah, he said they found a completely cut wire bundle near the ramp, too. Just another thing that could have gone catastrophically wrong. Stan admits right in the interview, after that first mission, he seriously questioned if he'd survive his tour. Especially remembering another helo that went down with all crew lost just the January before. It really hit home, the danger.
A brutal first taste of combat rescue. What about the pilot they were originally trying to rescue? Banyan 03, did they get him?
Yes, eventually, on that same overall mission.
Yeah.
After Stan's crew had their mechanical issue, the original Highbird became the Lowbird, and another Highbird helicopter came out. They went back in after dark and got the pilot.
Yeah.
His call sign was actually Dachshund.
Dachshund 03, okay.
Right. Stan said that rescue was pretty uneventful, except an A1 fired a rocket nearby. And the next morning, Dachshund briefed Stan's crew, told him the area was packed with enemy, lots of casualties after Stan's crew had been forced out. And get this, Stan later found out the same pilot, Dachshund, got shot down again almost exactly a year later and rescued again by the 40th.
Wow. Talk about persistence on both sides. Now, Stan also talks in episode 37 about missions in what they called the Bad Area around NKP Channel 89. What made that place so nasty?
NKP is Nakhon Phanom Air Base in Thailand. Channel 89 was its Ta Khan navigation channel. And Stan explains, if you flew 090 degrees for 60 miles on that channel, it took you straight into the Mujia Pass.
Mujia Pass. That was a major part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, wasn't it?
Exactly. The main entrance into Laos for the trail. He describes it as trails flanked by these huge karst limestone cliffs, riddled with caves. And those caves were full of anti-aircraft guns. A massive choke point, heavily defended.
So flying in there, as described in episode 37, sounds like running a gauntlet.
Pretty much. Stan said helos would come back from the Mujia Pass, shot up from every conceivable angle, top, bottom, sides, front, back, just peppered.
So how did they even attempt rescues there? What were the tactics?
Speed and surprise, basically. He mentioned doing spiraling descents to lose altitude fast, using the terrain, the karsts, for cover on approach, then a fast, low ingress right into the target zone to minimize time exposed to fire. He mentions an incident, Boxer 2, 2, and 1, where two helos landed on opposite sides of a river there. He wasn't on that one. But he did fly missions like Wolf 06 in that same area.
Wolf 06.
Yeah, a really tough two-day effort. First day, the hoist operator actually saw the survivor get captured by enemy troops while they were attempting the pickup. Just awful. They did manage to rescue another survivor from that incident the next day, though.
And Stan mentions in episode 37, the enemy sometimes used downed airmen as bait. That's horrific.
Yeah, a constant danger. That's why SAR efforts in those areas were huge operations. Layers of fighters stacked up overhead, providing cover, trying to suppress the guns, and speed was critical. He says their stats showed an 80% recovery chance if they got to the survivor within the first hour.
Only an hour.
After that, the odds dropped way down. The enemy had time to close in, set up ambushes, not just for the survivor, but for the rescuers, too. So crews would sometimes orbit near NKP for a day or two before committing, trying to time it right, get the guy before he was surrounded.
The pressure must have been immense. He also details the Laredo mission in episode 37. Sounds like another major one.
It was. April 5th or 6th, 1970, he recalls. An F-4 got shot down around 2 p.m., hitting Turk Parks along Route 7 near that Bartholomew Pass area again. Pilot bailed out at 6,000 feet. Peeper went off.
Okay, one down.
But then, during the search, one of the A-1 Sky Raiders, the Sandy Escort pilot coordinating the rescue, he got shot down too.
Oh no, so now three guys on the ground.
Exactly, a Sandy pilot was rescued that night. Then the next morning, Stan says the first lighters, the North Alert crew, launched at dawn. Stan's crew, on home alert as Lowbird, launched around 10 a.m. So you had four rescue helicopters eventually involved for the two remaining F-4 crewmen.
Four helos again shows the commitment.
What was the plan this time, according to episode 37? How did they prep the area?
Standard procedure, but intense. The A-1 Sandys went in first, flying low and slow, trying to draw fire to locate the guns. Then the OV-10 Broncos call signs nail, hey one, marked the gun positions with Willie Pete's smoke rockets. Stan's crew became primary around noon, refueled. By the time they went in, around 2.15 p.m., the intel was there was only one active gun left near the survivors. Just one gun. Still risky.
Definitely. An A-1 pilot told them the plan, how he was going to try and draw that last gun's fire. Stan's H-53 went screaming in up a stream valley at 170 knots. Then the A-1 calls, kill your airspeed. Stan drops the penetrator hoist, starts lowering it, sees smoke almost immediately.
Good sign. Did it go smoothly from there? The pickup itself? As smoothly as possible, I mean.
Relatively, yeah. Hoist landed right at the first survivor's feet. But while he was doing that, the co-pilot spots the other survivor's smoke, maybe a quarter mile off. So to pick up the first guy, Frontier Alpha, was his call sign. Then head for the second smoke.
Okay.
As they approach the second smoke, Stan sees movement. Thinks maybe it's enemy, because again, the smoke was downhill from the actual survivor.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was in a green flight suit, maybe tiger stripes. Hard to see. But to get the hoist down, pick him up too.
Got both of them. Excellent. Egress.
Pilot did a pedal turn on the way out. Stan hosed down the ridge lines with his minigun just in case. Whole thing. Ingress to egress, maybe 10 minutes. Super fast.
10 minutes for two pickups under potential fire? That's incredible efficiency. What about the flight back? Episode 37 mentions the formation.
Yeah, flew back to Udorn with the OV-10s and A-1s that supported them. Found out later the F-4 guys were from the Triple Nickel Squadron. And the hybrid pilot on their mission said he saw a 37mm AAA bursting near them right before an A-1 finally took out that last gun.
Close call even then.
Always. Stan really stresses in the interview how vital that teamwork was. The Broncos, the Sky Raiders, the Jollies. The A-1s especially. They could find guys and lead the helos right in. And he mentions again how the H-53 speed, that 170 knots, helped get them in and out quicker than the older H-3s could.
It's a vivid picture of complex, dangerous teamwork. But Stan also shared some later moments in episode 37, didn't he? Amidst all the intensity.
He did, yeah. Got to have those moments, right? He remembered an A-1 pilot flying alongside their huge H-53, really slow dropping flaps, gear, everything trying to match their orbit speed, which could be like 95 knots. The A-1 eventually stalled, dropped away, then came back up and did it again, just messing around.
Chuckles. Bit of aerial humor.
Exactly. Another time, on a north orbit, the scheduled airstrikes finished. They got the order to return to base. But an A-1 pilot spots Russian Mi-8 helicopters resupplying North Vietnamese troops down in Laos.
Whoa, enemy helicopters.
Yeah, They had to call up the chain, talk to Brigham, the airborne command post, get permission to engage, eventually got the okay, and the A1s took them out. Unexpected target of opportunity.
Those breaks from the routine, even if still dangerous, must have been memorable. And operating in Laos itself, episode 37, paints it as this strange, complex situation.
It really was. Officially, Laos was neutral, right? It's supposed to be just the Pathet Lao communists versus the royal Lao government with, you know, Air America providing some quiet U.S. support.
Right, the secret war.
But San points out the North Vietnamese had hundreds of thousands of troops in Laos, completely violating that neutrality treaty. So the U.S., while sort of publicly respecting neutrality, hit the Ho Chi Minh Trail running through Laos incredibly hard. Arguably, more bombs dropped on Laos than South Vietnam.
And they had to maintain some deniability.
At those Lima sites, yeah. He mentioned covering the U.S. insignia on their helicopters with sheet metal panels sometimes, just to keep up appearances for the Thai government, who were hosting them but didn't want direct evidence of offensive ops launching from their soil. Stan says the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos looked like the moon, just craters everywhere. And the NVA actually used the craters for storage, hiding supplies.
Resourceful.
Incredibly. He saw an AC-130 hit one of those caches at night during the 72 Easter Offensive. Caused this massive chain reaction, secondary explosions going off all over. He also mentioned C-130s and even D-6 bulldozers being used to deliver huge 15,000-pound daisy cutter bombs to clear jungle or take out bridges.
Just immense covert firepower being used, which leads into maybe the most famous covert op that he was involved with, peripherally at least, the Sun Tay Raid. Episode 37's account of the lead-up is fascinating.
It really is like a spy thriller. Starts in June, he says. Pilots start disappearing TDY, supposedly for night recovery system training. But by October, they're still gone, and the crews left behind are told to stop flying the good C model H-53s, have to use the older B models for training, which they hated because of less fuel.
Strange orders. Did they suspect anything?
Stan said one pilot he flew with started wondering if it was about a specific POW, maybe Pete Latham. Things felt off. Their commander even went on R&R back home, started asking questions about his missing pilots, and the FBI contacted him, told him his helicopter, his crew, had unknowingly been part of prepping a secret mission.
Unknowingly involved.
Wow. And what happened right before the raid kicked off, according to episode 37? Well, there was this unrelated but very demanding mission first, November 14th. A log truck accident in Thailand, 3 Americans involved, 2 killed, 1 badly injured with a head injury. Stan's crew flew out, waited hours, then had to fly the survivor and the bodies to Bangkok. Very low altitude because of the head injury, below 700 feet. Got guided in by a local GTA guy, landed on a soccer field, long wait again, flew back late, totally exhausted.
A tough day. And then the Sun Tay prep ramped up.
Yeah. A few days later, more crew vanish, off to Tok Le Air Base with PJs. Then Stan gets called into ops one afternoon, just handed a slip of paper. Sterilize 5 helicopters.
Sterilize? What did that mean?
Detail checklist. Upload tons of ammo, 18,000 rounds on 2 birds, double the normal load. Cut and cap exterior lights that couldn't be turned off completely. Remove all identifying info base names, locations from weight into balance logs, everything. Make them untraceable back to Thailand. The Thai government needed deniability.
Stripping their identities. Then what? Episode 37 describes the arrival.
About 9 p.m., a C-130 lands. The guys who've been gone TDY get off, including Stan's sponsor, Dave. Stan asks him what's up. Dave just says, tomorrow morning it'll be international headlines.
Shelly.
11 p.m., another C-130. This one has Colonel Bull Simons and 57 Green Berets, the elite assault force. They pick one of the faster H-3s, not an H-53, for the actual insertion. Guys in white coveralls, engineers, start modifying it, putting C-4 explosives in the drive bay.
Hey, why?
The plan was to deliberately crash land that H-3 inside the prison compound after the troops got off. They'd practiced it stateside on a mock-up. Bull Simons was adamant Stan heard, clear the POW area of fire before landing.
Okay, so this is it. The Sun Tay raid itself.
Yep. The raid goes in, takes down guard towers, command buildings, swift assault. The other helos wait nearby. But egress was tough. Heavy resistance, SAMs launched. An F-105 Wild Weasel escort got hit, but the pilots were rescued by an H-53. The engineer on the crash-landed H-3, Leroy Wright, broke his ankle in the landing, got immediate med care, and flown straight back to the U.S.
And the result? Did they rescue the POWs?
Tragically, no. The POWs had been moved from Sun Tay months earlier, back in August, because of flooding. Nobody knew. But the raid, despite not finding POWs, had a huge unintended positive effect.
How so?
Because the U.S. proved they could raid deep into North Vietnam, the North Vietnamese got spooked. They consolidated all the American POWs into bigger compounds, like the Hanoi Hilton, which meant the end of solitary confinement for many, massive boost to morale, better communication, and unexpected silver lining. And Stan adds this detail. As the H3 taxied out for that one-way mission, the flight engineer just tossed the logbook out to a mechanic, knew it wasn't coming back.
An incredible story. Stan also shares some very personal close calls in episode 37, times he thought he might really have to jump.
Yeah, it really brings home the constant risk. Mm-hmm. He mentioned a friend shot down in an H-43, whole crew captured, another friend in an H-3 near NKP, helicopter on fire. PJ bailed out, captured. The engineer, Stan's friend, bailed out too, but forgot to unhook his gunner's belt first. Dangled below the burning rack until he got free. Landed on a ridge, got rescued by the Navy after signaling with a cigarette lighter.
Just harrowing escapes. Did he have one himself like that?
The closest he felt, he said, was flying over Steel Tiger area in Laos. Transmission oil pressure started dropping, temporizing classic signs of gearbox failure looming. He was mentally prepping to bail, watching the torque gauge, any spike, and he was gone. But they managed a running landing with basically no oil pressure left. That was the one time, he said, he was truly ready to jump.
Makes your palms sweat just hearing about it. And then there was that near miss during the scramble with the film crew there. That's in episode 37, too.
Oh, yeah, that's a wild one. Film crew at Ubon, documenting a rescue mission. Scramble order comes North crew. Stan says he just ran flat out through the alert building, literally jumped over cameras and crew to get to the helicopter. Airborne in 5 minutes flat.
5 minutes. Incredible. What was the mission?
Rescue an OV-10 pilot. Contested pickup. Two previous helos have been shot down trying. A1s were working the area laying smoke. They make a hard left turn towards the pilot and call elephant grass. Stan's lowering the hoist. And the autopilot roll amplifier fails. Helicopter starts oscillating side to side, making hoist work super difficult.
Just what you need.
Right. While he's fighting that, the number one gunner opens up on muzzle flashes from another ridge. Stan finally gets the survivor on board. They bank left to get out. And Stan's minigun jams.
Jams at that exact moment.
At that exact second. And right then, an A1 supporting them fires a salvo of rockets that flashes right through Stan's doorway, where he would have been firing if the gun hadn't jammed. He thinks he would have shot right into the A1. Pure chance prevented a friendly fire disaster.
Unbelievable timing. So despite all this danger, episode 37 shows there were still those humorous moments, interactions with the other pilots.
Definitely. Keeps you saying, I guess.
Yeah.
He mentioned the A1 pilot with the Snoopy doll co-pilot again. Just silly stuff. Had a photo of an A1 guy in 70s still wearing the old leather helmet and goggles. Looked like something from WWII. Said they had a really good relationship with the Sandy pilots overall.
That camaraderie seems crucial.
Yeah. And he tells another story, picking up a Sandy pilot south of Mujia Pass. An OV-10 is marking targets' trucks, a cave gun. The A1 calls for a paveway, a big laser-guided bomb, for the cave gun. While they're sorting that out, an H-3 from Da Nang zips in and rescues the downed Sandy pilot. The OV-10 pilot directing traffic had no idea the rescue was already over.
Chuckles. Communications lag.
Seems like it. And he mentioned a PJ in their unit who is a great artist, drew caricatures of everything, even their CO, Colonel Mordecai. Those little things matter.
For sure. Stan also reflects a bit in episode 37 on the after effects, dealing with these experiences long term, what we'd call PTSD now.
Yeah, he's quite open about it. Said initially back home he'd have these vivid nighttime experiences, reliving the heat, the smells, the tension, the sounds. Really intense flashbacks.
How did he cope?
He found that talking about it helped a lot, especially with other vets who understood. Said it reduced how often it happened. He connected with Ralph, the guy from Military Tales who did the interview, through their shared aviation interest. That ability to talk was key. He also mentioned meeting South Vietnamese pilots later in San Antonio, just being blown away by their combat time, 10 plus years sometimes, versus his too. And their dedication, defending their homes, puts things in perspective.
It absolutely does. And his memories of Laos itself, beyond the combat episode 37, gives glimpses of that too.
Yeah, not just the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He remembered being on standby at Lima Site 20, watching Lao T-28 pilots constantly taking off, dropping bombs nearby. Vang Pao, the Hum Mong leader, had his HQ there. Stan called him charismatic. Saw young Hum Mong soldiers, small guys but deadly with their weapons. Saw the PJs giving medical aid to Hum Mong kids.
The human side of it.
Right. And he described Laos as beautiful too. Diverse landscapes, the Bulovins Plateau, waterfalls. Used to be tiger hunting country.
Yeah.
Mentioned guys getting gold bracelets made in Vientiane. One A1 pilot even had his bracelet as part of his E&E evasion and escape plan.
Gold as an escape plan?
Yeah, part of the whole E&E setup.
Yeah.
They filled out questionnaires with personal info for authentication if captured. got blood chits, promising rewards for rescue, even gave hair and nail samples. He also recalled landing at Long Ting, the big secret base. Said it felt primitive, like something out of the Steve Canyon comics, with a really challenging runway.
Just a completely different world. Lastly, episode 37 touches on the Jolly Green call sign itself. It lived on after Vietnam, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Became iconic. Rescue units back in the States kept using it. Stan mentioned his own tour in Alaska in the mid-70s. They were initially Jolly Greens, then used other Jolly Calls. Definitely. And he shared one last funny story. General Allison Brooks visiting Udorn back in 66 or 67,
yeah.
And some of the squadron guys painted giant green footprints up the base water tower. Bit of unofficial Jolly Green pride.
Chuckles. Love it. That spirit. Well, Stan Nelson's account in episode 37 of Military Tales is just incredibly rich, a really powerful personal window into aerospace rescue during the Vietnam War.
Absolutely. His experiences, the details he shares in that interview, they really highlight the bravery, the skill, and that intense camaraderie of the crews. It's humbling to hear about.
And that Jolly Green spirit, you really get a sense from him, it was way more than a call sign. It was this deep commitment to saving lives in truly unbelievable danger.
The stories Stan shared in episode 37 are just one perspective, of course, but they represent so many experiences from that time. We hope this deep dive into his interview encourages you, the listener, to maybe look further into this crucial part of aviation history.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Stan Nelson's experiences from Military Tales, episode 37. And maybe here's something to think about. Stan's story, like so many from that era, shows ordinary people rising to extraordinary challenges. Where else in history or even today do we see that same spirit, that courage, skill, and dedication making the difference against overwhelming odds? Something to ponder until our next deep dive.